Hi, everyone. Tom Salemi here. Welcome back to the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. You are holding a very, very special episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Not only are we bringing you a great conversation that I had with Paul LaViolette, he, of course, being the new CEO of Pulse Biosciences, formerly sort of SV Health. He's still managing his portfolio there, but not making future new investments. But, of course, the former COO of Boston Scientific as well. We talked about a lot of things, sort of the origin story for the medical device industry, why Guidant was such a good deal for Boston Scientific, and why Paul LaViolette decided to take the CEO role at Pulse Biosciences. So lots of good stuff in there. Before that goodness, though, you get to hear our very first installment of our new FOMO series, The Future of MedTech Opportunities. We recorded a number of great interviews at Device Talks Boston. You'll be hearing them each week here on Device Talks Weekly. This FOMO episode is brought to you by our very good friends at Protolabs. And if you'd like to sponsor a future episode of FOMO, we have a lot of great guests from the Device Talks Boston studio. Please shoot me an email, reach out on LinkedIn, and I can put you in touch with the right people. This is an opportunity for you to get your brand assigned to some of the best minds in medtech. So Tony Jark certainly qualifies and then some. He's the Vice President of Digital and Machine Learning at Intuitive. And Tony and I had a great conversation at Device Talks Boston, hearing about the future of the OR. So enjoy our very first installment of FOMO. We'll be including this in future episodes of Device Talks Weekly. If you want to record your own FOMO, reach out to me again on LinkedIn or shoot me an email. My email is tsalemi@wtwhmedia.com. And I'll put you in touch with the right folks, and we'll see what we can do. We'd love to have you on the podcast. So you've got Paul LaViolette. You have Tony Jark of Intuitive. That's a lot, and we're bringing you the Newmarkers newsmakers. Chris Newmarker, of course, is back. We'll talk a little bit about the news of the week and who killed James Garfield and Warren Harding. That kind of came up, and I'm sounding very stern when I say that. It was as light a conversation you can have as past presidential assassinations or deaths in this case. So that being said, one final thing. We've got our Device Talks Tuesday coming up on Tuesday. I will not be there. My very good friend, Kayleen Brown, our managing editor of Device Talks, will be hosting the Device Talks Tuesdays brought to you by Integer. The title is Planning for PFAS-Free Coding Solutions in Interventional Medical Device Design, an important and critical issue. Go to devicetalks.com to register for that. You can watch and participate in that for free. It's best to do it live, but you can do it at your convenience as well. You can still ask your questions, and Integer will get them. So go to devicetalks.com to register. Once again, Kayleen Brown will be hosting a great conversation on PFAS. So check that out. Other than that, I think we should just get this podcast episode started. There's so much to come. I don't want to delay it any further. So let's go. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Newmarker, how are you, sir?
Doing well, Tom. Doing well.
It's Friday morning here, the day after Juneteenth. So, nice to have the Thursday off, but it's a little hard to kind of get the momentum in on a Friday morning.
I know. It's like, I mean, no, it's kind of. I mean, I've got little kids, so it was like a wild, fun, crazy day.
Well, it's a great holiday and welcome addition to the roster of federal holidays.
I think it makes more sense than a lot of other federal holidays. I mean, this is like the anniversary of the end of slavery, you know, one of the worst things our country ever had, like that finally ended, you know, so it's a good thing to mark.
Absolutely. One of those things that I'm embarrassed that I didn't really know about until the last few years, so. I guess we're making progress, Chris.
Well, hopefully I'm not going to kick a hornet's nest, but, you know, I don't think they need President's Day. I think, I mean, if we went back maybe to the Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday, like the presidents that were actually great people. Like, I mean, let's honor them, but, you know, I don't know. I mean, I grew up in Warren G. Harding's hometown. I mean, and he wasn't all that, you know. So
I went to James A. Garfield Middle School. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't know how he got a school named after him.
But, he got shot. Tom.
Yeah. I know, but just
people felt bad for, I mean,
that's a fair
fun,
point.
Fun
that's
quick story. Point.
Is going to be fun.
The assassin, one of his big defenses was, I didn't kill him. The doctors did, because they were so bad at what they did. And one of the fun things was that Alexander Graham Bell invented a metal detector to try to find the bullet in Garfield. And it actually just detected all the bed springs. So they were going and looking for the bullet in all the wrong places. So that was
sad. You never disappoint, Chris Newmarker.
I try to deliver. Yes,
you are a fountain of trivia. You are.
Yes.
We both have surprisingly full Fridays, so we're going to roll right into Newmarker's Newsmakers. All right, Chris Newmarker. What's number five on your haunted, award-winning Newmarker's Newsmakers list?
Hey, number five on the list was SS Innovations announcing that they completed their first robotic cardiac surgery in the Western Hemisphere, like here in the Americas. They got this done in Ecuador, and just kind of like another step forward for their Mantra 3 robotic surgery system, which they're planning to submit to the FDA in July. And I remember you had some really good thoughts on LinkedIn about this. This is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly the cardiac surgeons drive a lot of the agendas at hospitals. So the thought is, if you can get them behind a robotic system, they'll be a favorite of hospital systems. And Intuitive clearly feels that way too, appointing their first modern day head of cardiac surgery. I mean, they initially started out as cardiac surgery just a couple of months ago. So this is going to be a fight for the cardiac surgery space, which is it's exciting.
Yeah, exciting very stuff. Exciting. It's exciting to see Intuitive's going back to their roots. I mean, that was what they kind of wanted to do robotic surgery in originally, and now they're heading back there. And and last week the interview that I did with the Corsum CEO, he was kind of talking about, I mean, he thought that the surgical heart valves, that was one of the paths that they were going to take in the future, was that we're going to have robotic procedures to do heart valve replacement laparoscopically.
Was Warren Harding the president who died like 5 weeks after taking office? Or am I confusing?
That was William Henry Harrison. Yeah. Like,
really? Was it Henry Harrison?
Harding died on the train back from Alaska. He wanted to visit every state, so he went up to Alaska. And
I knew he died in some unusual manner. Okay. So glad you were here. I was going to Google it, but I'm like, no.
There was a rumor around Marion, where I grew up, that his wife killed him. But I mean, that's just terrible rumors. Terrible.
They always blame. Yeah. Always blame the spouse. Okay. What's number four, Chris Newmarker?
We are going off the rails today, Tom. Number four on the list, we've got Medtronic unveiled the name of their that's going to go onto their diabetes business when it separates from Medtronic and becomes its own company. So what do you think they called it?
Well, I know called it because you sent the list over, but I want to give them credit. It's MiniMed. Yeah. And I want to give them the award for not trying too hard. Like, I think it's a good, perfect. You had a great name. Use it. Move forward with it. You don't have to go too deep. I think it's a great name.
You don't have to pay consultants to do all this. Exactly. Just, I mean, it's a recognized brand name. They can move forward with it. So that'll be great.
Smart move. Yeah. Smart move. Yep. All right. What is number three?
Number three on the list, Virtual Cision, another robotic surgery company they've been watching a lot. They've appointed a new CEO, and I apologize if I'm not going to pronounce this right, but Jim Alexa. So he's from, he's coming to them from Intuitive, where he led U.S. sales. So, I mean, that's a really notable hire to come from that surgical robotics giant over to Virtual Incision. And he sees John Murphy, who's, been in the corner office there at Virtual Incision for 13 years. Very, very, very notable hire. I know on LinkedIn we saw a lot of, positive feedback from that decision.
And I'm on Jim's LinkedIn profile. We just connected this week, and his last name is spelled A L E-C-X-I-H, and there's no how to pronounce my name, on his profile. So, Jim, apologies if we're not getting it right. We're writers, first and foremost, and it's always easier to spell than to pronounce. But yeah, no big news for Virtual Incision. John Murphy's been their CEO since their very early startup, so this seems like a natural progression. And yeah, Jim had a lot of success at Intuitive, as folks, like you mentioned, commented on LinkedIn. But he's also was at ViewRay and some other medical device companies helping to ramp up their commercial operations. So he seems like the right person to take a Virtual Incision and mirror from kind of a, I think, as I said on LinkedIn, a curiosity to a real commercial powerhouse. So good hire by Virtual Incision.
Yeah, exactly. Be really great.
All right. What's number two, Chris Newmark?
Hey, number two on the list, we have Associate Editor Sean Hooley. We're recording this on Friday, and the American Diabetes Association scientific sessions are taking place in Chicago right now, and Sean is there. If you're around,
he's gonna be under the heat dome, huh? They're gonna get some heat this
this weekend. Same here in the Twin Cities. I think that
stay cool, Sean.
Totally, yeah. So hopefully you get some good breezes off Lake Michigan there or something. But a lot of diabetes tech news rolling onto mass device and drug delivery business news, right now from Sean, as he, covers all the developments going on at ADA 2025. And, one of the really interesting things is, we're seeing a number of announcements from companies with insulin pumps, pairing their pumps with the glucose ketone sensor that Abbott presently has under development. And there's a lot of interest in this. We have news, we had news rolling out onto Mass Device today about Ypsomed and CamDiab joining other companies that want to pair their pumps. We have news from Beta Bionics as well. We have Sequel MedTech and Tandem, saying they're gonna, they have agreements to pair their insulin pumps with the sensor. So just a lot of partnerships going on, and we'll definitely keep an eye on Abbott as they continue to develop the sensor.
Absolutely, certainly helpful news for folks who have diabetes. It's nice for them to have options. I'm sure folks will find one system works better for them than others, so it's nice for them to have a choice.
Totally.
Or multiple choices. All right, Chris Newmarker, we both got to go. Number one on the Newmarker's newsmaker?
Hey, well, number one on the list, we have good news, bad news, for Medtronic when it comes to the Hugo surgical robot that they're, moving forward with, and they're efforts to compete against Intuitive in the soft tissue surgical robotic space. So, I mean, we had news that, on the good news side, we have news that, Medtronic is partnering with IRCAD North America out of North Carolina, to develop surgical training around Hugo. So they've got a strategic collaboration with a research institute to get that strategic training going. They're also going to be helping them with, surgical training for their Affera cardiac ablation system, mapping system. So that'll be good. The opposite side is that they have a safety notice in Europe now, where they're already marketing Hugo, related to its console. That there's power supply problems with it, with 25 complaints investigated. So, we'll be watching that, see if there's anything, see how Medtronic works through that. They've submitted Hugo to the FDA this year, so we'll see if that affects anything going on with the efforts to get Hugo approved here in the U.S.
All right, Chris Newmarker, thanks for those Newmarker's newsmakers. Now we're going to introduce a new feature, our FOMO feature, the future of medtech opportunities. We here at Device Talks have many great conversations with many great leaders in medtech. Some of them will be featured on our keynote slot on the podcast, but we're creating an opportunity for others to share their stories as well. So today's story is brought to you by Protolabs. It features Anthony Jark. He's the Vice President of Digital and Machine Learning at Intuitive. The title is Surgery 2035, A Glimpse into the Future of Operating Rooms. So Tony and I again talked at our studio at Device Talks Boston. If you want to sponsor one of the other great conversations our Device Talks team recorded at Device Talks Boston, go to LinkedIn, reach out to me there, or shoot me an email. My email is TSALEMI@WTWHmedia. Would love to put you in touch with the folks who can help you be part of a future Device Talks weekly episode. All right, now let's hear from Tony Jarek. Again, he's VP of Digital and Machine Learning at Intuitive. Hi, everyone. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. We're here with our Future of MedTech series, looking at the surgical robotics space, and I have the perfect guest for this conversation. Tony Jarek is Vice President of Digital Products and Machine Learning Insights at Intuitive. It's quite a title, Tony. Sound very important, and we're really glad to have you on the video to talk about where we're headed. So we've talked a few times before. I always love your path into MedTech because it kind of comes through robotics, correct? How'd you find your way to Intuitive?
Yeah, no. Well, thank you for having me here, Tom. So I came to Intuitive out of graduate school. In graduate school, I was studying how humans coordinate movement and how we can restore movement after paralysis or stroke. And so we were using a lot of optimization and machine learning techniques to predict how we might be able to drive the control strategies in paralyzed limbs. And at that time, I actually became connected with the medical research team at Intuitive, did an internship where we applied many similar techniques to data streams on the robot. And we started characterizing surgeon movements, and we started to characterize surgeon skill and performance and learning. This was the precursors to surgical AI and data science. And I joined the medical research team at that point in time as a data scientist or machine learning scientist. And then I've had a fortunate career at Intuitive where we've been able to grow very much that core technology into a backbone of our digital products.
That's great. And what role or what problem do you see surgical robotics companies like Intuitive solving? What are you trying to achieve?
Yeah, I think we're after the big problems in healthcare. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at the standard of care globally, there's a huge opportunity for improvement. A few examples that we have, you know, it's over a year from when you first present symptoms in lung cancer to when you're definitively diagnosed. And that year is precious time that potentially risks the life of that patient. Endometriosis, 5 years dealing with symptoms before you actually get treatment. Mitral valve, 7% mortality rates 1 year after. And so I think this is a tremendous opportunity, just a few examples, for us to bring end-to-end solutions that go from diagnosis through treatment and elevate the standard of care.
You must look across the landscape of surgical robotics companies and see what you've done and see what others are starting to do. What is your assessment of where we are today with surgical robotics? If we want to go to a baseball analogy, what inning are we in? I feel like we've made a lot of progress, but we're just really starting to scratch the surface. I'm mixing so many metaphors in there. Pick whichever one you want to use.
Yeah. I think every year the opportunity gets larger and more exciting, mm-hmm. right? I've been at Intuitive going on 15 years, and I'm more excited now than I ever was before.
Awesome.
Because I feel like maybe the bases get bigger or there are more bases added in front of you. I don't know if I butchered the analogy
further. Doing a terrible job. I hope people will get our point.
Yeah. But I think that we're all after very common goals, right? We're after improved patient outcomes that deliver a better patient experience, improved care team experience, lowering the total cost to treat, driving access, 24/7 access to the right level of care that then elevates surgical outcomes for those patients. And right now, I think Intuitive is bringing a set of capabilities as part of a robotic platform, but now connected to a digital ecosystem that creates a continuum to holistically solve those problems versus bringing point solutions.
So where are we headed? Let's look ahead 10 years. I feel like with all that's going on, and I know AI is obviously on most people's minds and in most people's interviews, what you've described earlier, you've been working with machine learning for years in control of data and understanding of data. But I feel like now we're beginning to crystallize where we might head with telesurgery and AI assisted surgery. Where are we headed? What will surgical robotics and what will, I guess, the OR look like in 10 years?
I think it's a great question. I think it circles right back to those big problems. These are hard problems to solve, mm-hmm. and not just to solve once or at one institution, but to solve globally across institutions to kind of take the bottom quartile, the bottom half performance of surgery and elevate it to better care. And so I think some of the technologies you mentioned, telesurgery, mentoring telesurgery, which is on the continuum of telepresence, which we have today, where we're connecting surgeons across distances to be able to drive better clinical decision-making, to AI, which I see just like many other technologies in sensing, robotics, controls, advanced imaging as an enabler as part of that ecosystem. And so I think hopefully what you'll see is you'll see the endpoint improve, where we're solving the total solution of diagnosing lung cancer sooner and treating it instantly to be able to solve those problems. And AI and telesurgery will just kind of be the foundation in the background alongside robotics to be able to support it.
So, sounds exciting. I feel like, again, we're on the cusp of seeing some really amazing things. Thank you for your contribution to all of that and for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Tom. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks again to Protolabs for sponsoring this FOMO episode. Thanks to Tony Jark for taking the time to share his vision of the future. Once again, if you want to be part of FOMO going forward, reach out to me on LinkedIn or shoot me an email, TSALEMI@WTWHmedia.com. Now let's hear my conversation with Paul LaViolette. He's now CEO of Pulse Biosciences. Well, Paul LaViolette, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. It's an honor to have you. I'm finding it hard to believe we haven't talked on this forum before, given that I've been doing it for a while, and you've obviously been doing what you're doing for a while. So I'm glad we're checking this box.
Same here. I've been doing what I've been doing for more than a while.
Well,
it's fun. It's fun, and it keeps me coming back.
Let's unpack that a little bit. I know you had said it initially you didn't want to go through your entire career, but the question we always open up with is how did you find your way to medtech? What was the entry point for you into this industry?
I would say, in comparison to what I see and have seen over the last 20, 30 years with spectacularly prepared individuals coming out of school, having studied engineering and lab sciences and having worked at Bain and McKinsey and gone to Harvard Medical School and everything else, I was really an accident waiting to happen. I was I went to business school. I was literally in the first year of business school. I signed up for an internship at a company called Kendall, which of course was a medical products company, at that time, a subsidiary of Colgate-Palmolive. Over time, became part of Covidien, and now part of some of the franchises still persist inside Medtronic. But I became a summer intern as a market analyst at Kendall. This was in 1979-80. And then I went back to school to finish my second year of business school, and they called me up and said, "Hey, listen, we've got an opening for some contract work, some consulting work. Would you do that?" I did that in the fall. An individual left to go to Gillette, they said, "We'd like you to join full time." So this is 1980. I was given an opportunity to have a full time role in a subsidiary of a Fortune 50 company in medical products, in marketing. So I took it. I finished school and worked in concert. And that led to a couple of years in market analytics research, then a first associate product management role. And then I had a 10-12 year career in product management, marketing management, vice president of marketing, and then became a general manager for the first time around the age of 31.
So you never did direct sales, never carried a bag?
You know, it's funny. I was asked to, in the prospect of joining the company, essentially an accelerated management program.
Uh-huh.
And they said, "You can go into that if you want, or you can get a real job and we'll give you real accountability," which I took. But my assumption, Tom, you know, you go into marketing and you really want this sense of having been in the field. You want that direct customer interface. And so I was planned to and fully expected to move into a territory. Around my third year, they basically said, we have different plans for you. We're not going to send you to Cincinnati to carry a bag. We want you to move." So I don't know. I will say this. I missed that. Uh-huh. And I've carried that, I'll say, almost as a chip on my shoulder as a commercial person, right? It's like, listen, I didn't carry a bag. I've had thousands of salespeople work with me, and I've always held myself out to be the person that must be the most responsive to sales, the most responsive to customers, the best listener, the best translator of market-based messages. I think in part I overcompensate to this day for that because I skipped a direct selling role back in the early 1980s.
That's interesting. So make sure you've been more empathetic toward the sales teams and to getting them what they need.
At least I feel that way. And I hold myself accountable to do that to anyone who's listening right now. If I'm not doing a good job, let me know.
So you did rise through the ranks quickly. You were president of C.R. Bard and then, of course, joined Boston C.R. Bard's cardiology division. And then, of course, joined Boston Scientific in 94. And that's about 4 years before I started covering medtech. And I just remember those days with the stents, the drug-eluting stents. It was really a crazy time to be in medtech. What was it like for you at Boston Scientific during that time? I feel like that was, I don't want to overuse a cocoon sort of metaphor, but that's where medtech really seemed to get on, stand on firmly on both feet. Do you agree?
I do agree. And I think, quite honestly, I don't think we even used medtech as a phrase back then, right?
So right.
Medical technology, we made medical products, they were medical devices, but medtech was not a thing. And I will say, of course, there were multiple markets evolving and emerging at the time, but I do think the interventional cardiology emergence really was a tip of the spear in the overall field of device development, of interventional medicine. So many categories followed. And I think cardiology to this day remains one of the largest, most competitive, most dynamic, highest M&A, highest R&D as a percent of sales, highest investment in clinical, most PMAs. So that really was an epicenter, I think, of med tech emergence. And so if you go back my formative days at Bard, many folks wouldn't know, had the first coronary angioplasty system in the world. And so it gave me an opportunity to run the first interventional cardiology business ever. And that was wonderfully, I'd say, foundational, to again, the interface between physicians and engineers and to developing a product pipeline, to working on evidence development in the earliest days of interventional products. Boston Scientific was, I would say, nominally in the cardiology business in those days.
Uh-huh.
It had an organic division called Mansfield Scientific, which had a little bit of an electrophysiology franchise and a little bit of a balloon POBA, right, plain old balloon angioplasty franchise. That was about it. But I would say, and actually, rest in peace, Pete Nicholas used to say we're fifth in a four-horse race in cardiology. And so in my first days, 1994 and 5, preceding the SciMed acquisition, we walked the halls and talked about, should we buy Cordis? What ACS was being spun out of Lilly, the medical device divisions of Eli Lilly at the time. So there were a handful of cardiology, interventional cardiology, nascent assets that Boston Scientific looked at and tried to decide what would be the best platform for us to really substantiate our cardiology strategy. That begot the merger of SciMed and Boston Scientific in 1995. And I think that really was an accelerant. That was a catalyst to Boston Scientific's explosive growth over the subsequent years. We infused a fantastic set of executives from SciMed, a great market leading product line in intervention. This all, you mentioned it, all preceded the arrival of stents, right? This was really kind of the early days of balloon angioplasty, the first rapid exchange systems. Then you got into the first ancillary tools, the first coronary imaging systems, the first atherectomy systems. Those all preceded stenting. So that was the 90s coming into the 2000s when obviously J&J started with the Palmaz Schatz stent. and then the stent, wars really began. But those 90s were formative, both as cardiology grew, multiple interventional spaces started to follow, and if you will, ride that wake. And Boston Scientific really went through years of spectacular growth. Lots of organic development, lots of synergy from M&A, and then continuous inorganic growth with deals putting the company into, for the first time, the interventional neuroradiology space, multiple cardiology expansions, the first time getting into neuromodulation. So it was a really expansive period of growth for the company, over which period I saw it grow from $250 million when I started to $8 billion when I left.
I really thought that deeply as to the role of interventionalists in the parallel growth with medtech. Did medical technology drive the growth of that specialty, or did the demand of that specialty really drive the growth of medtech? Or it might be just a chicken and egg question. Which is which?
Well, I do think it is it's a chicken and egg question, but it really required both. If you think about the handshake, the virtual handshake between the interventionalist and the provider of equipment, the provider of tools, the provider of technology, the sitting down over a cup of coffee and talking about why I couldn't access a certain part of the coronary anatomy, what I would need in order to make a device track better, function at higher pressures, cross a lesion with lower profile. It was the aggressiveness of the cardiologist wanting to create a new interventional field, the phenotype of cardiology being aggressive, assertive, wanting to innovate, and then the handshake with technology partners who were able to listen and iterate and to drive that innovation process. I do think that was one of the first embodiments of the clinical industrial partnership that now I think defines the med tech field and is in many ways taken for granted. It's been reduced now to a science. If you look at the biodesign process, None of that existed back then. It was really different disciplines getting together, listening carefully, going back, prototyping, innovating. We didn't have 3D printers. We didn't have a lot of things back then. We had extruded tubes. We had bottles of super glue. We had razor blades. And people tried to figure out how to make better devices. And it worked.
Do you see the biodesign efforts? You opened up by saying, by drawing a contrast between your qualifications and the qualifications of a lot of young people coming in the industry now. What's your assessment of the biodesign programs, all of them, not one in particular, and sort of what kind of professionals are they producing for the medtech industry? Are you excited about where we're headed?
Well, I think it's spectacular. Honestly, I think the professionalization, if you will, of the innovation process is really what we're talking about. You're trying to proceduralize and add rigor to the needs identification and the solution creation, and then the development process. All of that, any one of those, if they're off base, right? You can drive a really great development process, but if you haven't properly identified the underlying clinical needs, the physician requirements, and now the much more complex clinical economic requirements of healthcare delivery, you can end up with a good product that won't sell, or a great device that can't be afforded, or you name the unsatisfactory outcome. So I think the concept of wrapping that all into an innovation management process, and then infusing it with talent, and bringing in cross-functional expertise, frankly, defining things, again, phrases that we didn't use in the 80s and 90s, like voice of customer, those things are all now deeply embedded in an innovation dynamic that thousands of people participate in. It's very talented. It moves swiftly. It draws investment. It has higher yield, right? It has a higher hit rate, and that begets a virtuous cycle. That's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And that's in support today of a $600 or $700 billion medical device field. And that's power. Uh-huh. That sort of power did not exist 30 years ago. So yes, I think the biodesign process is a wonderful contributing factor. It's a sign of the maturation of our industry. And it is a healthy contributor to great innovation going forward. And I think, frankly, even at my advanced age, having seen a lot of great innovations, I can wake up in the morning thinking, you know what, there's still a lot of problems to be solved. And concepts like that are likely to continue to contribute solutions and bring new innovations and create new business opportunities, because we still have so far to go, right? Uh-huh. In how to treat more patients more cost effectively.
One final question about your time at Boston before we move on. You're COO. I think one of the more high profile deals in the industry, of course, Boston's acquisition of Guidant. It's now an integral part of the company, but there were some years in between when the deal closed, I think 2005, 2006, where what were some of the lessons that were learned from that acquisition? And I think you can make a deal and people can question it right from the start, but sometimes these things, I think, need time to sort of evolve and become what they could be. But what are some lessons, if any, you've taken away or took away from the acquisition, Boston's acquisition of Guidant?
Well, there were a couple, and I will reflect back on that time. Boston Scientific really felt we needed some transformative deal making, and of course the underlying premise of the Guidant Boston deal was to diversify Boston's cardiovascular business into cardiac rhythm management, and having that side by side power of interventional coronary and cardiac rhythm we felt would be extraordinary. That was the thesis. Seemed like a good idea at the time. Guidant, of course, stumbled, which, of course, was the underlying cause of the breakup between Guidant and J&J. That stumbling, right, that ultimate question about how damaged would that cardiac rhythm management franchise be, I think that was the wild card. And observers could look at Boston saying, well, you overreached, right? You overpaid in an effort to buy an asset that was troubled. Bear in mind, no one was saying cardiac rhythm management was troubled at the time.
Right.
And yet in the aftermath of those controversies, the New York Times investigative reporting into cardiac rhythm management and the break that was caused, the break that was most important for me, which I would not have anticipated at the time, was really that the defibrillator market, the ICD market, it was fast growing, right? The MADIT indications were expanding. More patients were eligible for ICDs. It was really a fantastic growth time in the marketplace. But bear in mind, a patient at risk for sudden cardiac death does not necessarily feel bad, does not necessarily feel symptomatic, and is often going into a general practitioner or a general cardiologist to talk about symptoms, risk factors, and the potential benefits, life-saving benefits of a defibrillator. And then they read in the New York Times, oh, actually, some of those defibrillators, you know, they may not work, or they may not go off, right? Because it's really an insurance policy. And so that loose handshake between general cardiology referring to an electrophysiologist who would obviously perform the procedure, do the implant, but a lot of patients started to say, you know what, I'm not quite so sure I want one of those. And that changed permanently the growth trajectory of the ICD franchise, which of course underpinned the acquisition rationale for Boston to acquire Guidance. So that was a significant setback that I don't think any observer of the CRM market at that time would have articulated. However, the hidden gem of the Boston Guidant deal was the replication of the drug-eluting stent asset. Of course, the divestiture of Guidant Vascular to Abbott was required because Boston was the leading interventional cardiology company. It couldn't buy another cardiology franchise. So that was divested. But in the process, we contended that from an FTC perspective, actually, we would create more competition if we replicated that drug-eluting stent franchise and kept that replicate copy inside Boston Scientific while sending the twin of that franchise over to Abbott. So Abbott became a full-fledged competitor owning Guidant Vascular and running that business and launching the drug-eluting stent there, while Boston maintained its original drug-eluting stent with paclitaxel and added to that a second drug stent franchise using an Olumis, and became the first company to have two drug-eluting stent flavors, if you will. And if you look today, Boston Scientific has maintained the interventional cardiology lead. And I think the split of that vascular asset was the key to that. So roll the tape forward 10 uh-huh. years. Yes, yeah. It was a difficult deal. Bear in mind, there was a stent thrombosis controversy at that time. Drug-eluting stents came under pressure.
That's right.
Boston Scientific incurred a corporate warning letter. The cardiac rhythm management business deflated. So I remember giving a presentation to Harvard Business School, and I think the title was, you know, even the perfect storm only had two storms. and the storms that Boston faced with the warning letter, with the Guidant consent decree, with the drug-eluting stent controversies of subacute thrombosis, with ICD, you know, falling down in growth because of the loss of confidence through the referral process. That put a headwind onto Boston Scientific that was unprecedented. And if you then said, well, all of this, you know, you did all this to buy growth. You spent $26 billion for Guidant. What did you get to show for it? And so, yeah, for a few years there, it was easy to criticize that as a bad deal. You shouldn't have overpaid. You shouldn't have gotten into a bidding war with Johnson & Johnson. I think a lot of those things missed the point. When I joined Boston Scientific, I like to tell folks, I was called to interview for a job at a company called Boston Scientific, and I lived in Boston and I had never heard of the company.
exactly.
So it was early, right? And then you go through the next 15 years and it becomes an $8 to $10 billion company and one of the stalwarts of the medical device industry, and look at it today. Uh-huh. The team there has done a spectacular job over the last 10 and 15 years. And so, yeah, it went through a period there of real difficulty, but I think its core DNA has always been very strong. I think that continues through to today. And yes, for several years, the company failed to generate shareholder value, and the deal looked expensive. But if you look at it today, one could easily argue that had Boston not done the Guidant deal, Boston would not exist today as a company. It would have been struggling. It would have been gobbled up. Who knows what would have happened. So had it been only a single drug eluting stent company with no cardiac rhythm management, who knows where Boston would be or if it would be here. So the strategy was not to preserve Boston Scientific, right, for posterity. Uh-huh. Strategy is always to build shareholder value. But in the process of trying to do that, a very strong, fortuitous, enduring and winning franchise was created. And a lot of shareholder value has been created over time by different eras of management. And I don't think that would have been possible had that team in 2006 not acquired Guidant.
Well, I appreciate the reflection, and folks obviously have heard of Boston Scientific today. So you did well. You obviously acquired a taste for the long haul and joined SV Health investors. I think it was SV Life Sciences at the time. We don't have to go through your whole investment history, but what was the move? Why the move to VC? And I'm happy to ask the questions, but I'd love to just unpack your assessment of where VC is today compared to where it was in 2008 when you joined, because I think it's markedly different.
I think it is markedly different. It was, I had at the time I was 2008, that was just about 30, my 30th year in management and operations. The 15 years that I spent at Boston Scientific was without a doubt 15, you know, spectacular years, and not a single day would I, you know, ask for a do-over, but it was exhausting. And so I was, I retired from Boston Scientific at that time, and did not have a formal plan. I joined a few public boards. I joined a few private boards during that period, but I did not specifically plan to enter an investment career. The team at SV Health Investors, principally Jim Garvey, who had been an operator himself and essentially the founder of the firm, said, "Hey, we really like folks of your type, right? Uh-huh. Operators, operator investors." And, you know, we talked about what it would be like to just be a lone wolf, if you will, on a few boards doing some investments versus doing that with a team. And so he said, "Why don't you join us as a venture partner, see if you like it." Uh-huh. And so I joined. I tried to lead a few deals. I identified investment prospects. I joined a board. I think I might have taken over one or two portfolio companies as a chairman, and really just kind of got deeper and deeper into the early stage world. Of course, Boston Scientific gave me a great head start in that regard. We did a lot of technology assessment, a lot of market assessment, a lot of investing. So it was a nice natural extension. It kept me very active with entrepreneurs, with innovation, with disruptive technology. Honestly, Tom, if you say, I think to most people in med tech, how can it be more fun than that, right? Uh-huh. And so I looked at that and said, wow, I get to really, I always loved leading organizations, and I certainly felt like I was effective, but I just felt there was an ease and a fit in doing venture investing that carried many of the benefits and didn't have some of the management challenges associated with large businesses. So it felt great. And I did that for a year or two on a part-time basis. And then the team asked me to join as a full-time partner. Then I became managing partner. So that was a fantastic transition, not one that I formally planned in that regard. And of course, had a lot of friends in venture, a lot of friends in the med tech space, spent a lot of time talking to folks about this move or that move. And it just felt great. And so I continued staying on a few public boards, a few boards sort of on the side, but really focused principally on building a portfolio within SV. And as I mentioned to you earlier, continue with several of those companies now, representing my most recent investments done in the last several years. So that continues to be a great way to spend time. I still love being on large involved with large companies, but the venture world has been great. Now, to your point, it is more challenged, right, than it was 10 and 20 years ago. It's more challenging because over time results as it relates to pure IRR for med tech funds has been challenging. And I think that's generally a function of the stacked risks associated with med tech. When you think about larger plays, earlier stage investing, going after disease modifying, if you will, innovation, that requires years of development and then clinical development, then regulatory timelines, and then payment risk on top of that. Of course, not every market is the same, but it, when you look at some of these great examples, you know, I'll give you an example, SetPoint Medical, which is a really high flying story now as a neuromodulation platform. I looked at that with Morgan Thaler Ventures in 2009.
Yep.
And I was spectacularly impressed by the founding physician, Kevin Tracy. I loved the science. Neuromodulation in general was still an early concept, but the idea of having neuromodulation that could address inflammatory disease was breakthrough and exciting. That was 17 years ago.
That's a great point. Right?
And so now that's an extreme case, but of course that technology today is drawing high interest, has strategic investors. It's a very intriguing story. Well, yeah, but who wants to do the IRR calculation on Series B, you know, for right. that? So it's been, that's, I think, maybe an extreme example, but it's been a challenging evolution because of the stacked timelines, the stacked risks, and I'll call it the hot and cold trends that you can have in M&A, right? And when an IPO window closes and there are no early stage IPOs in med tech, and you have the aforementioned Guidant goes and St. Jude goes and this company goes, Bard goes, all of a sudden, you know, the consolidation of the industry, fewer M&A exit prospects. Uh-huh. And if you're investing in a company that has no IPO viability, has 7 years guaranteed of investment before regulatory approval, has to raise a Series E to go commercial, may or may not have more than two or three buyers at the end, that's a needle to thread as an investor. And you can create some great outcomes, but you can also create some very long holds and some challenged returns. So I think that is the status of medtech. It's still healthy, but it is not as thriving as it was a number of years ago.
So we talked earlier about the biodesign programs, how they're producing these folks who were better trained, who have already done a lot of the due diligence, the legwork prior to even pitching these companies. So you would think that there would be a greater number of opportunities to invest. However, given the external factors, you mentioned the IPOs and the M&As, you're right, the investors have a harder time. So are we looking at, do you feel like what we're looking at now, the population of investors, this is a correction? This is like this is the number of investors that this industry can support? Or do you think that we could see new investors come and sort of bring, I guess, more volume and more number of potential backers of these startups in the future? Or yeah. is where we are where we should be?
Well, we have corrected it. I think there has been a pullback, and that's unhealthy, right? That is less capital. That requires a correction. That means fewer companies received capital, more companies struggled. That's that painful high friction correction that's been going on for the last number of years. Now you put next to that the scale of med tech. I think the sophistication that you mentioned of entrepreneurial initiatives, and you do see it. And I'd say the other convergence factor here is the digital health, right? So you have with digital and connected devices becoming more part of med tech, then you have digital investors who want to try to understand how to get a bite out of healthcare, right? Healthcare, when you step back and say, okay, wait a minute, why would people do that? Well, look at the scale of healthcare. Look at the value in healthcare delivery as measured in trillions of dollars, uh-huh. right, in the United States. Look at the scale of medical device markets. Look at the scale of markets like atrial fibrillation that now becomes a $10 billion projected to go to $15 to $20 billion market. These are real numbers. There are a lot of investors that look at that and say, how do we get a piece of that?
Yeah, for sure.
And so then I do think there will be some corrections where folks look at the pullback of med tech. You say, okay, well, is there an opportunity for new money to come in there? It may not be early stage class three devices, but I do think there will be new flows of capital from these vectors, these perspectives, these perches that look at the med tech industry and say, you know what? You can enter with some lower risk. You can enter with a data-centric strategy where the device is not as big a deal as the data play that it generates. And before you know it, you have a different business model and you're into healthcare data. So I think there are different facets of medtech that will spur on growth. Uh-huh. And that is drawn by innovation and the ability for medtech to treat more patients and lower the cost of care, for which there is an insatiable appetite, right, for providers and payers who are trying to figure out how to lower costs. And that's where the innovate, there is tremendous desire for that innovation. It just may be slightly in a different position than it might have been 5 years ago.
Interesting. All right, well, let's move on to where you are today. I think I can say in all honesty, you're not very good at retiring, Paul. You retired from Boston Scientific and took an adventure career. Now you've decided to take a break and be the CEO of a publicly traded medtech company, Pulse Biosciences. How did this opportunity come to be, and why this move now?
Well, first of all, I'm not a retiring type. I'm very energetic. I don't really know how old I am. I've been blessed with good health, and I honestly don't know that I'm not 40. So don't turn the camera on, but I don't know that I'm not 40. So it works for me, and I still have passion for innovation and for technologies that can change markets. Uh-huh. I'm a competitive person, by the way, and I like to change markets. I like that race. Pulse Biosciences is a very innovative platform company in what is generally well known today as the PFA space. And so it's not unlike saying 30 years ago maybe nobody knew what Boston Scientific was, 10 years ago maybe nobody knew what PFA was,
right.
Today nobody doesn't know what PFA is. Exactly. And so I became familiar with the company a year or two ago and joined the board, and really, in the process of joining the board, I just did some homework. I've been through my investment world. I've been in the EP space. Well, I've been in the EP space as an operator for a long time. I've been in the AFib space. And again, no one can miss the dynamic of PFA and AFib these days. So that, of course, we've seen that coming for a couple of years. It was not clear how rapidly and how demonstrably it would come, but it was coming, and it's come big time. So around about or in parallel with all of those PFA dynamics, I became familiar with Pulse Biosciences, and quite frankly, having looked at technologies as an investor for the last 17 years, having worked with innovation for the last 45 years, I had not seen a technology platform that was this stimulating to me, maybe ever. Huh. It's an advancement of PFA, in a proprietary setting, right? With a highly patent protected position coveting, essentially, a domain on the spectrum of energy delivery related to nanosecond pulsed electric fields. And in the generation of those extraordinarily short pulses, we have the potential to create different therapies to stimulate a different mechanism of action, and to really revolutionize more than a handful of therapeutic markets. So I looked at it, it's a mature company, it's a public company, it's been thoroughly supported by spectacular investors. Bob Duggan is the chairman and principal owner of the company. He's been remarkably successful both in medtech and in biotech. And he had a vision for this therapeutic potential 10 years ago. That has put the company in a position where it is today with multiple regulatory clearances, multiple applications underway, multiple IDEs pending, multiple markets to enter. So it's a very intriguing story, a very compelling energy with a remarkable array of therapeutic opportunities, a great team. And so I just thought, wow, that is a lot of fun. I had the fortune of sitting in the boardroom for a short amount of time. And when the board asked me to run the company, I just couldn't come up with a reason why not to.
That's great. So how does a company, and we'll wrap up with this, like Pulse Biosciences, you mentioned everyone knows PFA, Boston's obviously a leader in the space, Medtronic, there are a lot of larger players moving in, some smaller ones as well. How do you see Pulse competing in the future and grabbing the share it needs to be successful?
Well, first we're going after markets that include EP, but also include entirely non-vascular and non-cardiovascular opportunities. In fact, the first indication we're pursuing under a soft tissue ablation indication is the treatment of benign thyroid nodules, which is a fascinating market, part of the ENT spectrum, and really an opportunity to provide hundreds of thousands of patients a year an opportunity not to have their thyroid removed surgically. So just to put it in perspective, when we think about Pulse Biosciences, there are many ways for it to create value other than the direct shot of pulmonary vein isolation and EP. That being said, we think our PFA energy has the opportunity to revolutionize PFA within EP. And if you think about the step function that Boston Scientific has brought to AFib therapy with dramatic reduction in procedure times, ease of workflow, improved safety, all derived by delivering a non-thermal ablation energy. And if you then say, can NSPFA improve each one of those variables? And are we already seeing clinical evidence of that? I think the answer is yes. So my ultimate mission is that everything about PFA is something to like, but importantly, not all PFAs are not created equal.
Interesting.
And we think our PFA, because it resides in that nanosecond domain, which allows us super short pulse durations, driving more amplitude, more voltage, it really creates an entirely different pulse electric field. And that is a key to unlocking many different therapies that will ride the wave of PFA, but we think will also set new paths that current PFA will not be able to address.
So this sounds similar to the way we talked about interventional technologies. This is...
Well, if you think about it, right, how many waves of, whether it's cryo or RF ablation, microwave energy, HIFU, there have been many waves, Tom, and they're all focused on revolutionizing surgical interventions. How do we take a surgery, make it less invasive by capturing the therapeutic power of an energy? And really, this is the cutting edge of that same wave. Just going forward and with, I think, greater potency than we've seen in any of the prior energy forms.
Fantastic. Well, Paul, I've enjoyed every conversation we've had, especially this one. Thank you for taking the time.
I appreciate it. Honored to be with you.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks again to Protolabs for sponsoring our FOMO conversation with Tony Jark of Intuitive. Thanks to Paul LaViolette for his time and his story. One of the real, I think, founders of the medical device industry and now the medtech industry. And thanks, of course, to you, our great listeners of Device Talks. Please join us on Tuesday for our conversation led by Integer. Once again, it's planning for PFAS-free coating solutions in interventional medical device design. You can register for that at devicetalks.com. My friend and colleague, Kayleen Brown, will be leading that conversation. All right. We will be meeting at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. We're updating the website. We'll be making some changes to the event, and it's going to be a great couple of days. Lots of new things planned, so keep an eye out on West, or keep an eye out on our website, west.devicetalks.com, for more information. All right, thanks everyone for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast.